This is Audible.
Podium Publishing presents The Cycle of Aron, the complete trilogy. Written by Edward W. Robertson. Read by Tim Gerard Reynolds. The White Tree. The Cycle of Aron, Book 1.
Chapter 1.
It was the dog's fault. Dante was about to die. The ruins of the chapel hunched behind him, hiding the man who'd soon kill him. Because of the dog, he was 30 miles from Bressel, 10 from the nearest farm, and a world away from help. Despite his isolation, he didn't doubt his body would be found. Corpses had gravity, as if the vapors released by death were starkly visible to the mind's eye. If the man who'd attacked him didn't find his body lying in the cold grass and colder wind, a farmer or a pilgrim would. But they wouldn't know who he was. He'd be a body, a nothing, another lump on the surface of a world too large to understand. He sat up in the grass, pain rushing down his side and thigh. The chapel was supposed to be abandoned. Instead, he'd found a guard waiting inside its walls. The man had cut him. Badly. He'd been lucky to escape into the fields with his life. Blood gleamed dull black beneath the overcast sky. Dante's stomach cramped. He fell back into the grass, panting, tears sliding down his temples into his hair. He caught his breath and shrugged off his cloak. It tore easily. Too easily. Would never have made it through the upcoming winter. He bound his wounds, tying them tight, grimacing against the dizziness and nausea. Wind hissed through the grass and pines. He tested his leg and found that he could stand. It would be stupid to go back inside. Dumb like a severed arm is dumb. But the man lurking in the temple wasn't a looter or a squatter. He was a guard. Guards, by definition, guarded. The man wasn't there to protect the chapel itself. That had been torched during the third scour. The following century of weather and vandals had ruined the rest. Stonework rubbled the field, cracked rocks fuzzy with moss. Holes spotted the pitched roof, darker than the clouds. The Temple of Aron was 4 generations and a hard day's walk removed from the last time and place anyone had cared about its god. It was a cold night, and the sporadic rain was colder still. And yet, there was a guard. Dante was onto something. He drew his knife and crept toward the chapel, smelling the tall, wet grass as it soaked against his legs. Nothing moved except the wind-stirred trees. He touched the damp stone of the wall. He felt his way forward, fingers trailing the wall. After a few steps, they fell into empty space. He froze, breath catching in his chest. That moment of cowardice saved his life. A man coughed from so close Dante could smell his breath. The guard emerged from the hole in the wall into the cloud-occluded starlight. His sword hung from his hip. He gazed into the bobbing pines, most likely imagining the boy he'd cut up not 5 minutes before, curled beneath the cold boughs, heat and blood slowly ebbing from his body. The man wandered into the grass. Dante pressed his back against the wall. He waited for the guard to take another step, then lunged forward and slashed at his hamstrings. The man screamed and fell. He rocked in the grass, clutching the backs of his legs. Dante danced back and wondered what the hell to do next. "Get back!" the man yelled. Dante found himself. He pressed his boot against the man's ribs. "Where is the book?" "What book? I'll cut your throat," Dante said. His voice caught. He swallowed. "You'll be a body in the woods, eaten by badgers." "I don't know of any book." The guard pawed a bloody hand at Dante's breeches. If there was anything here, they took it back north long ago. Then why are you here? Your health? The man started to speak, then took a long, shuddery breath, squinting at Dante's face. How old are you? Would you ask Death his age? Dante said, and felt immediately foolish. I'd say he looks about 14. I'm 16. My name is Dante Galland, and if you don't tell me where you keep the book, I'm the last man you'll ever see. I'm telling you, it's gone. Return to Narashtovik, where men don't want to burn it. Dante knelt and dug his knife into the guard's smooth-worn leather shirt. The iron tip clicked against the man's breastbone. The guard sucked air between his teeth, eyes white and watery. Dante gulped down a retch, withdrew the knife, and hovered it over the man's heart. I hope its secrets are worth your life. Stop! The man wriggled his shoulders, pushing himself into the sodden grass. It's in the basement, downstairs. I didn't see any stairs. Third row of the graveyard, fourth stone. There's a ladder underneath it. I haven't seen anything down there but candles and prayer books. I drank all the wine. But if there's a book, it's down there. They stared at each other in the damp autumn air. Dante couldn't leave the man here. It would be like cleaning a deer. Focus on the knife's edge. Keep your fingers out of the way. Work fast. Concentrate on the cut. Wash up when you're done. But deer didn't talk back. They couldn't call you a murderer. Dante steeled himself and poked the blade between the man's ribs. You promised, he gasped. And you tried to kill me. Dante drove down hard on the hilt. The guard bucked, legs thrashing, knocking Dante off balance. He grabbed the knife's handle again and leaned on it with all his weight. The man went as slack as a summer pond. Dante's stomach spasmed. He felt 1,000 feet tall. He wanted to die. He was frozen, stunned, waiting to be smited by the man's god. The wind whispered to him through the needles of the pines. All this for a dog. He'd seen it just that summer. Its body lay on the bank of the creek, miles upstream from his village. Short, skinny trees grew so thick around the stream that you could barely see the sky. One of the dog's paws dangled in the water. Its fur was clumped with blood, its eyes shut, legs rigid. Flies whirled around its nose and lips. A noose trailed from its neck. Its death was a stain on the face of innocence. Dante shrank behind a birch, gripping its smooth, papery bark. This was his place. There was nothing between it and the village but marshes and ponds. A few hills with grass on their crowns and trees in their folds. A couple of shacks, too, but their roofs were staved in, homes to no one. You could hunt it, perhaps. It was common ground. But it was otherwise useless land. Unless, like Dante, you had a thing for exploring. He spent whole days following the creek, turning stones over in its quiet pools, throwing pebbles at water striders, poking at snails to watch them suck into their shells. He was too old for such things. He knew that. He just didn't know where else to go. Leaves crackled 30 yards upstream from the dog. A man in a bright male shirt stepped out from the trees and knelt beside the water. He cupped his hand, drank, and flopped back on the bank to pluck burrs from his black cloak. A silver icon clasped it around his throat. The emblem rayed like a tree or a star. Finished, the man stood, stretched, and started downstream toward Dante. The man's hand whipped for a sword. Dante breathed through his mouth, rooted in place. The man stalked forward and stopped over the dog. He hunkered down and prodded its throat. The stream splashed along beneath the clouds. The man drew a knife, put it to the dog's throat, and sawed briskly. Dante tasted bile. The man pulled the now severed noose from the animal's neck and tossed it into the creek. He then touched his knife to his left hand. Blood winked from his palm. The air blurred around his hands. Small, dark things flocked to his fingers, moths or horseflies or, bad ideas, black motes that clung to the blood sliding down his wrist. They congealed into something round and semi-translucent. The man lowered his hands to the dog's ribs. The ball of shadows flowed into the motionless body. He fell back, smirking, and pressed his bleeding palm to his mouth. The dog kicked its legs. The man in the mail shirt got to his feet. After a faltering, stiff-limbed try, so did the dog. The man scratched its ears. It whined. The man laughed. Still whining, the dog backed up the bank and limped into the trees. The man belted his knife, glanced down creek, and followed it into the woods. Through all of it, Dante could sense what was happening the way he could smell cold or feel a shadow on his skin. When the dog shivered up to its feet, that was the world showing him just how big it really was, and that if he wanted to wield what the man in the bright mail had drawn from the air, he would have to come find it. Half dazed, Dante ran back to the village. No one there had seen the man come through. When Dante turned and gazed at the creek winding its way out of town, the woods and fields looked pale and common. The snails and water striders were just bugs. Dante went to bed and couldn't sleep. When he was a child, his dad had made lights dance in his hands, told stories of playing bodyguards for dukes, of hiring on with ships and using his talents as a soldier doctor. That route was technically illegal. Only royals and the church could employ the ether users, but it wasn't the law that had taken his father away. 9 years ago, the man had sailed west. He'd stayed there. Perhaps he'd died along the way. In the morning, Dante worked up his nerve and asked the monk who cared for him about living shadows and a silver star or tree. The monk's face grew distant. After a moment, he explained that before anyone now alive in Malon had been born, shadow-wielding men carried the Book of the White Tree and worshipped the old god Aron. But they'd been burnt out of the land, the men and their books, during the third scour. The monk had once read a fragment of the book. The rest was lost to the ruin of the past. The monk retreated into the monastery in search of his notes on the fragment. 2 weeks later, Dante went to Bressel in search of the book itself. There he spent his pennies buying beer for the capital's archivists and churchmen. One mug at a time, Dante learned the book wasn't a sort of recipe of spells, but the holy text of the Aronites, quite comparable to the Calavar of Gashan, or the Silver Thief of Carvajal. The scholars and priests agreed that all known copies had been burnt, but that, if any remained, they could be identified by a cover bearing a white tree. That had been it. Dante ran out of money, ran out of ideas. Empty-handed and out of options, he tracked down one of the temples and headed into the woods. The wind surged through the trees. A strange chain connected him from the dog to this place. Because of it, a man lay dead at his feet. He wiped his knife and hands in the grass and headed around the back of the chapel. Gravestones dotted the swaying grass. The fourth stone of the third row was flinty and black and flat. Dante nudged it with his toe, then dug his fingers under its lip. He strained against the stone and pivoted it into the weeds. It revealed a hole hardly wide enough for a man to pass his shoulders. Dante squinted into the gloom. The trapped air smelled musty, faint with the human odor of sweat and skin, the scent of another man's house. He shrank back, fighting a sudden terror for what lay in the darkness below. It wasn't anything as certain as eels, or as vague as monsters that slunk through the outlands of his imagination, but something in between. Pale things with tentacles of squid, the intelligence of men, and the cruelty of the stars. He leaned over and spat, counting two before it splattered. So, it had a bottom. The rungs of a time-smoothed ladder descended from the starlight into the blackness. Dante dropped his legs over the edge and scrabbled for a rung. The ladder creaked. Hand over hand, he descended, armpits slimy with sweat, until he stood in a circle of faintest light at its bottom. Dante owned two things worth stealing. The first was his boots. The second was the only thing his father had left him before sailing into death or waters too warm to leave. He took it from his pocket. A torch stone. A small white marble. He held it in his palm and blew. It warmed and glowed. In the soft light, dust caked the slanted shelves along the walls. Dante poured through moldy cloth, water-spotted braziers, foul-smelling candles. A patina of age coated everything, greasy and yellow-gray. There were two shelves of books. Dante's heart leapt, but they were all copies of a common prayer manual he'd seen in the library of Bressel, and the vendors in the binding district. He stuffed the least mildewed in his pack anyway. He swept through the basement, wall to wall. He turned in a circle, hunting for anything he'd missed, then went through it again, piling up the junky relics in the middle of the room, and prodding the shelves and drawers for hidden compartments. What he'd taken as a stool turned out to be a scuffed-up chest. He smashed its rusty lock with a brick, and was rewarded with three sludgy bottles. With waning patience and waxing despair, he searched the small basement a third time, moving as slowly and carefully as he could make himself go. At the end, he wandered to the circle of starlight and gazed up the ladder. It would be dawn soon. At some point, the guard's relief would find the body cooling in the yard. Maybe not for days, but for all Dante knew, a second guard had arrived already and was already scouring the grass for the killer of his friend. Dante was wearing down, too. The scabs of his cuts dribbled blood with every too quick gesture. He was tired and thirsty and sore. The sphere of light shrank back toward the torch stone. In thickening shadow, Dante sat down on a desk. It was too big to have been lowered down the hole as it was. They must have brought it down in pieces and nailed it together in the cellar. His hope contracted with the light. The first frost would come any day. He'd used up half his cloak for bandages and didn't have a cent to replace it. If he went back to Bressel, he'd starve and freeze. If he returned to the village, he'd regret it all his life. The stone flickered, throwing the room into deep shadow, revealing a crease in the shelves near the ceiling. Before Dante could be certain it was there, the light blinked off for good. He shuffled across the blackened room, candlesticks clattering away from his feet, and bumped into the wooden shelves. He climbed to them until he could press his palm against the cobwebbed ceiling. He'd seen the crease just below the top shelf. He scrabbled his fingernails against the coarse wood. They slid into a crack. Splinters drove under his nails. Bit by bit, he pried the false top away from the shelf. With a high-pitched groan, it fell away and whapped against the floor. He smelled dry paper and earthy leather. Dante reached blind into the crevice, heart beating hard. There couldn't possibly be anything lurking inside. There was no chance he'd feel a sharp tug and pull back one less knuckle than he'd started the day with. His fingers brushed over a flat, pebbled surface. It was the first thing he'd touched down here that wasn't dusty or greasy with neglect. He lifted the object loose. The shelf he stood on snapped in half. He hit the ground hard. His hip and shoulder roared with hammer blows of pain. He waited for the ache to fade to a dizzy tingle before he tested them for breaks. His limbs moved freely and without fresh hurts. By right, the fall should have left him broken-legged or paralyzed, trapped in the ground beneath the graves. He shouldn't have even made it this far. Except for dumb luck, he should have died 2 hours ago, struck down by the guard. His body splayed outside the chapel. Wounds long done bleeding, body held down by the wind and the clouds, until it merged with the dirt. But his bones weren't broken. The guard hadn't killed him. He was bruised and weak and leaking blood from his side, but the thing in his hands was a book. He'd held onto it as he fell, after he hit the ground. Now he stashed it in his pack and climbed back up the ladder. Up top, he got it out once more, turning it to face the charcoal-clouded starlight. On its cover, a pale tree spread its branches into the darkness. The white tree. Barden, the monk had called it. Supposedly, it was as real as the hills and stood in the twilight valley at the north end of the earth. According to the monk, even when they talked, Dante had been skeptical, wasn't it convenient that it existed so far away? It had sprouted from a god's own knuckle. Instead of bark and leaves and wood, it had grown of bone and bone alone. Its knotty trunk hewn from thighs and spines, its long limbs the arcs of ribs and the knobbly curls of fleshless fingers. Instead of flowers, it budded teeth. Book in hand, Dante laughed slowly, spooking himself. Why not just paint a bunch of flames around it, too? Or bind it in skin, and ink it in blood. That would be no less ridiculous than the gleaming bones on its cover. Yet there was something to it. He could feel its weight, its age. When he closed his eyes, he thought he could feel the power the man in the mail shirt had used to raise the dog from the creek. Goosebumps stood out on Dante's neck and arms. He packed away the book and hauled the heavy gravestone back over the pit into the cellar. Ragged black mountains hung to the west. To the east, Bressel was a full day's walk for a well-rested man. Dante slunk into the woods, shuffling along the rutted path hidden beneath the grass. As the sun rose, his legs faltered. He balled himself under a squat tree, shading himself from the itchy light of morning. Before he slept, he gave himself one last look at the book. Exposed by the daylight, the tree looked less absurd, less melodramatically morbid, and more like something that could be waiting in the wilds, if only the world were a slightly weirder place. He'd wind up standing beneath it within half a year. Chapter 2. The funny thing about robbery, Dante thought as he crouched in the filth of an unlit alley, is how little the concept of property meant to him once he'd started going to bed, hungry. So the watch could hang him if they caught him. That didn't mean he was wrong to do it. That just meant he shouldn't, under any circumstances, get caught. What kind of rule was so weak it had to be backed up by death threats? Who cares about being hanged when the alternative's starving? And if they really didn't want robbers in the city, why did they build their alleys exactly like the fish pens that funnel careless salmon into waiting nets? He heard footsteps at the other end of the alley and shrank down further. The moment the man passed, Dante clubbed him above the ear with the polished horn of his nice hilt. The man dropped, voiceless. As Dante stripped the body of its purse and the pair of rings on its right hand, he noted the man was still breathing. Good for him. The penalty for Dante, if caught, would be the same whether the victim lived or died. He didn't understand that either. A man of lesser principles would be tempted to kill the man he robbed so he couldn't be identified to the watch. Dante opened the man's jacket in search of a second purse and saw the taut-laced buckskin badge of the Tanner's Guild. He frowned. He didn't want trouble with guildsmen. They were too close to running the city these days. He hurried to cover the unconscious body with some shredded rags he'd found among the other garbage, then left the alley in something less than a jog. The walk from the chapel had taken 3 days. He'd managed about 10 stiff-legged miles the first day, then no more than 2 on the second, before he collapsed at a waterway so small it was more puddle than lake. He lay down on its cool banks, moaning and burning, and whenever he closed his eyes, the crystal-clear faces of men and women he'd never seen swam in his mind's vision. When the fever broke early next morning, he shuffled over the roots and rocks toward the city in the east, stopping frequently for rest and water. But he reached Bressel before sunrise, and immediately spent the last of his silver on a room for a week. He haunted the corners of its common room those first couple days, snaking from the safety of the wall to nab meat and bread when their owners' heads hit the table, or when they swayed off to find the privy. That had worked until the boy who worked the mornings threatened to throw him out if he caught him again. Dante nodded, face stony as he suffered the threats of a kid who couldn't be more than 14, then retreated to his room to pass the day throwing his knife at the rats that skittered across the floor. It was a pointless task, though. He knew he'd never work up the courage to spit them and set them over the common room fire. Robbing from there, and after what he'd done at the chapel, came easily. His nerves had threatened to give out on him on his initial try, but when he left his first mark in the forceful slumber in the shit-caked gutter of an alley, he wondered that it took so little effort to turn things they owned into things he owned. An average purse could feed him for a week, and this was just the money people carried around for luxuries and whims. What did they need it all for? He limited his own expenses to food, room, and candles to read by, but he knew he could have more if his interests had been in things instead of the book. Whatever authority had given these men their wealth was no more substantial than the power of a rabbit's foot. It felt good to carry, but when things went bad, it turned out all you were carrying to protect you was a lump of meat too nasty to eat, and the knowledge that somewhere a bunny had left the warren and never come home. He walked on. Boot steps rasped from behind him in the alley, and he started. He fingered the knife beneath his doublet, but let it be. Men who showed blades without a landed title or writ of the Guild of Arms were taught the things a whip could do better than a sword. Dante turned onto an arterial road and huddled in a doorway until the man passed without a glance. He knew he'd been jumpy lately, but how else should he act after a killing, the possession of a banned book, and multiple acts of armed robbery? It sounded terrible when you said it all at once. Most of the time he carried it lightly, knowing any deed done out of necessity couldn't be wrong. But other times he was struck by an emotion so powerful he wanted to cease existing altogether. At those times he muttered to himself, walking through the streets as if in a dream, drowning in the memory of the short shouts of those he'd robbed, the slackening face of the dead man at the temple, the snore-like expulsion of his last breath. It was clear he couldn't go on like this. It wasn't how he'd meant to live when he'd left the village for Bressel, but it was what circumstances had forced him to do. His only hope was with the book. If it could somehow teach him what the man in the mail shirt had known, he'd no longer have to look over his shoulder at every footstep or risk his life in the alleys just to keep from starving. His thoughts on how that power would help him were vague. He could hire himself out at the courts, he supposed. But he knew that once he had it, the opportunities of great men would find him on their own. The book was dense. not just in the literal sense of its thick-as-a-brick 800 pages, but dense with dozens of unfamiliar places and names, with warlords and sorcerers and tales he dimly remembered hearing as a child, cluttered with huge but bizarrely precise numbers like 432,000, stuffed with scores of words from a language he didn't recognize. Even its title was gibberish. Dante found some references to the book's people and places in the other book he'd taken, the prayer manual, but 3 or 4 hours of careful reading and cross-checking would let him read no more than 10 or 20 pages of the book itself. Yet when he tried to read it straight through, he found he'd absorbed nothing more than an occasional phrase, or, more often, an illustration. He went to bed angry, handling the words in his head for an hour before he could fall asleep. After 3 days of sluggish and haphazard reading, he understood he didn't know a damn thing, and set to copying all the foreign words and names out of the 40-odd pages of the book's first section. He bought a ream of paper and a bottle of ink with a week's price of food, and spent a full 7 days in the library at Bressel, the onion-domed, marble-faced structure meant to gather the wisdom of the world. It was well-stocked, he found, for works composed in the 50 years since its founding, and he filled his blank pages with the histories and places in the Book of the White Tree's beginning. The foreign words remained obscure, similar to the dialects they spoke up in Gask, he thought, maybe an archaic form, but far enough apart to render the study of Gascon useless. Many of the book's stories reminded him of Menoc, the mopey old god of grief and blackbirds. Dante had always thought its followers were a joke, the kind of guys who groaned through the streets, whipping their own backs with supple reeds to remind themselves of the agony of the physical world. They just had to shove it in your face. He thought they could learn a thing from the supplicants of Urt, the more fanatical of whom spent 23 hours a day sleeping and meditating in dark rooms with planks hammered over the windows. Its saints had been known to seal themselves in barrels for months at a time. Most faiths, he thought, could stand to learn the virtue of keeping their devotion to themselves. He bought the collected cycle of Menoc from a run-down storefront in the book district, and then a clean, simple doublet and trousers, so he wouldn't be thrown out of the monastery's open archives before his second foot hit the threshold. Then the money was gone, and rather than scavenging at the inn, he robbed again, splurging that night on roasted beef. He woke mortified at his opulence, vowed to skimp through the rest on bread and cheese, and spent the day rereading that first section. At its conclusion, he felt closer to his desire, as if this time he could see the shadow of what the wise man was supposed to glean from its contents, and here and there he even felt elevated by a glimpse of a world much wider than the one he'd known. Still, he felt helpless with idiocy, like understanding the book was like trying to move a mountain with a bent fork and 2 broken arms. And he slammed the cover, after marking his place, and pounded to the common room, where 4 cups of ale floored him. He woke, flushed and sweaty, sicker than the day after he'd been at the crumbling chapel, and wasted the day sipping water from the comfort of his bed, amazed that men could spend a life at the drink. After that, when he saw men drooping over the smoky tables, shambling outside to vomit on the street stones, he curled his lip, hating whatever weakness caused them to poison themselves that way. It took another week of eye strain and the glares of white-haired monks to find a match for the words he'd never heard. Narashtovic, an old language, a dead language, indeed from the north, from the Kingdom of Gask's earlier age, seen now in little more than the Frostlander's convoluted laws and nonsensical meal rites. No dictionary, of course. They didn't even have such a thing for the local language of Malish, other than a few vanity projects by wealthy men with no other diversions. But Dante found enough matching words to know he'd found their source. And there, the lore stopped. Nobody had books on all that old junk. Or if they did, they were clapped away in the private libraries of nobles and the obsessive collectors of the Scribes Guild. For now, Dante set his search on hiatus and returned to the cribbed script of his stolen book, a book he now knew was named The Cycle of Arawn. The mere act of finding its name shed fresh light on the first section that had so far given him such trouble. That night he read with mounting excitement, beginning to understand that Arawn was a god of death who didn't in any way seek it, a notion that ran heretical to those who'd won the third scour and denounced Arawn as a bloodthirsty monster ever since, but was nevertheless the undeniable interpretation of the text. This time, when he finished those first 40 pages, a chill of something close to ecstasy ran up the base of his neck. He had proof that at least one thing the other sect said was dead wrong. What else had he been taught on the basis of a mistake? How many lies had Dante taken on a faith that would prove unfounded? Did anyone know anything at all? Or finding times when the truth didn't suit them, had they all been repeating falsehoods and nonsense for so long they no longer remembered what was fact and what was invention? In his enthusiasm, he nearly brought it up with a monk of Menoc he'd become friendly with, thinking his learning would be greatly hastened by a man who'd spent his life studying such things. But Dante had the sense to ask questions about Arawn would be to invite a slew aimed back at him, and it wouldn't be long after that he'd be locked in the stocks, and the only thing aimed his way then would be airborne cabbage and the stroke of the lash. He already had enough attention. Since the night in the alley when he thought he'd been followed, he often saw a face in the morning when he ducked into the library, and the same face waiting for him when he returned to the street in the afternoon. They'd pretend not to notice him, but when he passed to haggle over pennies on a loaf, there they'd be again, gliding up to a stall like one of the flat-bottomed boats taking port in the river. Even in his new clothes, Dante couldn't be mistaken for rich. He looked like an apprentice at best, possibly a young scholar out on an errand. He might be easy enough to rob, but he hardly looked worth the effort. Nor did he know a single soul in town, wasn't old or important enough to have earned any enemies, excepting the guard at the ruined chapel, and he was too busy rotting to hold a grudge. But for however little sense it made, people were following him, and every day he spent in the stacks, he sweated buckets into his formerly clean clothes, certain his knife would slip from his waist as he bent for a book, and out him to the monks who hovered over their written treasures like robed dragonflies. Yet he didn't dare leave his room without it. The attack came the night after he'd translated the title. The blow should have killed him, but he saw the flash of steel and moved with a quickness he hadn't known he possessed to raise the Book of Menoc like a shield. It, too, was thick, bloated with footnotes and appendices and interpretorial digressions, and the attacker's dagger buried itself in the cover and stuck fast. Dante met the attacker's eyes and saw he wasn't a man, but a kneeling, the sharp face and elongated muzzle meant for cleaving the waters of the marshes and tide flats, the bumpy, translucent, toad-like skin, the thick glaze of a third eyelid over its wide and watery eyes. Web-footed things from the western archipelagos. They made good sailors and decent wharf rats, and though their light bones put the biggest of them in Dante's weight range, when the merchants of Bressel's bursting docks could hire three for every one real man, there were times on the wharfs when those froggish faces outnumbered their captains and mates 10 to 1. No one asked questions when they ended up dead, either, something that happened more and more the more they crowded the city and found themselves enmeshed in the crimes of the hated and despised. The thing gave a panicked grunt when it saw what had blocked its blade. Dante had 2 inches and 10 pounds on the kneeling, and when he twisted his book, the dagger popped from his hands without a fight. He lashed its knee with his boot and put a thumb to its throat as it fell, knife held high in his other hand. "Wrong book," Dante said. It bared its pokey teeth at him, watching his knife. How did you know? Its hairless brows pinched together, and Dante felt a pure instinct to cut its throat.
They told me to follow you.
How did they know it was me?
Dante Galland, it said.
His mind hung. Probably this creature had no idea who they were, but they had Dante's name, and they knew his rounds through the city. The kneeling's half-sphere eyes bulged in the hatchet of its face, and a base anger kinked in Dante's guts. He brought his blade across the kneeling's throat, and a hot fan of blood spat over his hand, and he jumped back and squealed. He wiped his hand on the thing's jacket, then wiped his blade, and by the time both were clean, it was dead. Steam curled from the gash in its neck, from the pool spreading beneath them on the grimy cobbles. He picked up his book and stashed the creature's dagger under his shirt. It was late and the streets were empty. He stuck to the broadest ones, the ones with oil lamps dangling on the corners. What few men he passed ignored him. By the time he reached the inn, he understood. The error hadn't been telling the chapel guard his name. It was in not making sure the man had stopped breathing before Dante left to find the book. The common room was stifling, full of braying laughter and clanking earthware. Dante paused at the bar, staring at the casks and cups.
"Your poison," said the keeper.
"Keep it," Dante said, starting. He tromped up the steps and locked his room and braced a chair against the door, for whatever good that would do. He sat down on his straw pallet, shaking from his shoulders to his toes, and set the two blades out beside him. 20 minutes later, he'd reread 5 pages of The Cycle of Aron, and couldn't remember a word. He spit on his fingers and snuffed his candle and opened his shutters to the street. Men stumbled down the thoroughfare, concentrating hard on keeping themselves upright. None of them raised their eyes to the shadow of his face in the dark window. By morning, the men of the chapel would know their agent had failed. Dante woke with a jolt. The light through the open window was grey, fuzzy. He was freezing. There was something he was supposed to do. He pulled the coarse blanket over his face, then opened his eyes wide, heart galloping. That was it. He was supposed to run away. He gathered his minor library, shoved the books and bread and dagger into his pack. He took his candles, his coin purse, and his spare set of clothes, dressing himself in his new ones. Already they were dirt-streaked, sour with old sweat, but at least they had no holes or patches. He wrote an obscenity on a piece of paper and put it on his pallet. Then, worried the innkeep might find it before the men of the chapel came here, snatched it up and crumpled it into his pocket. Dante liked the keep, didn't like the thought of the man's jowls drawing up at the kid who'd left his room a mess and insults as his only goodbye. He left the inn and made a loose spiral around the old quarter, giving himself time to sort out his thoughts and watch for pursuit. The cool air and light morning breeze off the river kept the stink of the city to a tolerable horror. Already men plied ox carts toward the docks, or scurried between districts with wax-stamped letters in their hands like the blades of angels, or dragged themselves home to begin sleeping it off. Dante didn't see anyone trailing him, but he knew he couldn't stay in his room. Nor could he leave the city without losing the resources he needed to understand the book. Where else could he go? The village? They were morons. He could count the ones who could read on 2 hands. The woods would be safer, but the men there lived like animals, preying on foot traffic like wolves, rutting like dogs, and dying when their short wicks burnt out, like rats. So he'd stay in the city, try to lose himself in a place where he couldn't carry a proper blade without being arrested within the day. Not that he'd know how to use a sword, even were he licensed. He was more likely to cut off his own fingers than fend off the swords of whoever the chapelmen sent next. And there would be others, bought with heavier coin than the kneeling pawn. Men who knew more about fighting than how to run and how to lay in wait. He paused at the corner of a broad avenue that led all the way to the docks. If all it took was money, why not hire an armsman of his own? Someone who could wear a blade without the watch hounding him for his papers. Wrestle was huge, bulging with trade, and with it, foreign merchants with more money than friends. The Guild of Arms was growing faster than all but the shippers. If these people wanted their book back so bad, let them try to take it from the kind of security only silver could buy. The sun hauled itself above the mists of the horizon, stuck behind buildings that sprung from 2 and 3 stories to 4 and 5, as Dante made his way toward the docks. At the end of the arrow straight street, the thin pikes of riverboat masts bobbed in the swells. The roads clogged up with people on foot, and single riders, and the clop of teamed carriages. By the time he reached the vast markets that crowded the shores all the way down to the mud banks, the roofs of the warehouses reared to 80 feet above his head. Dante hunched his shoulders, gazing at them as if he could hold the looming walls upright by force of will alone. He turned a corner, and the babble of commerce clobbered his ears like thunder after the flash. Men clustered in loose knots, shaking pages in each other's faces like the paper were no more valuable than leaves scraped from the gutter. Courtiers banged in and out of the doors of shops and warehouses that stood without a foot's room between their undecorated eaves. Mounted retinues jounced through the throngs, and the throngs parted without looking up from their business. Dante noted, with no small embarrassment, he appeared to be the only one fazed by the yammering crowds. He wandered around the square, not knowing where he was going, but with both eyes out for the crossed swords of the houses of the Guild of Arms. He found the first with little trouble. Men lounged at the walls of its mostly clear court, oiling their swords, occasionally shoving themselves upright to tangle blades for the benefit of the traders, who were easily distinguished by their dress, a bizarre confusion of flower-bright colours and the plain practicality of travel wear. Dante threw back his head as he approached, trying to mask his face with the same professional detachment he saw in the eyes of the merchants. One armsman stood out at once, a well-built man somewhere around 30, though to Dante's eyes everyone over 20 looked the same. His face and arms scar-crossed but intact, a couple shades duskier than most of the olive-toned Bressel locals, like he'd come up from the Golden Coast. After a moment's indifference, he glanced Dante's way, and Dante nodded. "What's your fee?" Dante said, folding his arms. The man raised a brow, and Dante knew he'd made a mistake. 2 chucks a day, the man said, referring to the silver of the late Charles III that had displaced most of the old coinage. And board. Why don't I just buy a horse and an armada while I'm at it? Dante reeled. He shot a glance at the waste purses of the nearest traders.
Well, you'll need something to get you around once the nails fall out of those boots.
The armsman spat between his teeth.
Maybe you could saddle up a dog.
Go to hell!
Dante blurted. He turned his back on the laughter that followed, eyes stinging. At the next yard, a smaller, louder, and more crowded affair, he hung on the edges, watching the exchange of money before he asked any questions. He thought he'd robbed his way to a respectable sum, but the traders tossed purses so bloated they could crush a cat. For a while he just wandered, browsing past a half dozen houses of prohibitive expense. The sun climbed. He began to sweat. hollow-stomached he came at last to the Freelancers, the few too feeble to represent the name of the Guild of Arms. Dante had seen plenty of healthy, battle-hardened men this morning, but if he'd never seen a soldier at all, he'd still know at a glance why these men were on their own. They ranged from the doddering old to the beardless young, 60-year-old men with grey in their hair and weakness in their arms, mingling with needle-thin boys who looked like 9-year-old girls. The handful of fit age would have been put down if they were horses. Patches over scooped-out eyes, pinned-up sleeves, bouncing limps where their tendons had snapped in a battle and never mended. Where the men of the guild proper had spoken through the clash of their swords, these rejects called to him in phlegmy voices like common marketeers. A young enough man peeled from their ranks and swiped a few left-handed cuts in the air in front of Dante's face. His right arm stopped just below the elbow. When he gestured, the smooth ball of his stump swung as dumbly as the blunt head of a turtle. "What's your price?" Dante said, skipping the formalities he'd seen the merchants make. Decorum ended the moment you considered hiring an armsman who only had one.
2 chucks, the man said, and Dante rolled his eyes. Per week, plus board.
Is that so? He sighed through his nose. He could actually afford that, so long as he kept up his late-night rounds rolling drunks, but he had the notion he'd be getting exactly what he paid for. He glanced around the Freelancers, searching for a stone in the rough, not a diamond, but maybe he could find a decent quartz, a smooth piece of glass. In some way, the presence of a bodyguard was more important than his skill at guarding. If nothing else, it would give Dante a few seconds to run while his man was being stabbed to death.
Still, they were so damned old, so damaged, and the couple who were young and whole didn't look like they'd be any better in a fight than he was, and that wasn't much at all.
Risking his life in the alleys for their pay seemed counterproductive if the help he hired were entirely decorative.
"What's crushing your junk? That's a bargain by any measure."
Dante turned to the voice and met a pale boy whose face was apple-smooth.
"How old are you?" he said, making no effort to conceal his frown.
15 and a half, the boy said.
Dante burst out laughing.
"And a half? What are you, 5?
Plus 10 and a half?
A real veteran," Dante said.
"You don't look like you'd know the sharp end of a sword if it were stuffed up your ass."
"Yeah, well, your mother's still got teeth marks on her tit, and not all of them are yours."
With nothing else going on in their overlooked yard, the other ungilded men chuckled, gazing on Dante with bloodshot eyes. He flushed and gave the boy another look. He had an inch and several pounds on Dante, despite being a year younger, though that still left him smaller than most boys his age, but he had a broadness of shoulder that might someday make him a decent soldier, if he could grow past his ludicrous wiriness. He had close-cropped blonde hair, and obviously didn't need to shave. His clothes were time-torn, worse than Dante's old set, thick with the black stitches of mending, and too short at his wrists and ankles. With a decent diet, and another 2-3 years, he might be in the yard of a real house. But Dante wasn't a horse broker making investments, he was a kid with a price on his head. If he hired this bodyguard and waited 3 years for the boy to grow into himself, Dante had the sense he'd spend 2 years and 364 days of that wait in the grave.
"What's your name?"
Dante said, readying himself for something to seize on. An odd gleam entered the blue of the boy's eyes.
"Blaze Buckler," he said.
"What?"
"I said, it's Blaze Buckler."
"Blaze Buckler?" Dante said.
He'd meant to win the crowd with a big laugh, but found a real one instead. He chortled stupidly.
"Did your dad read a lot of romances, then? When your mom heard that name, how did she not murder him, just strangle him with your birth cord?"
The kid's hand settled on his hilt.
My dad earned his name with his shield. I'll live up to mine.
With your belt, maybe, but for that you'll want to head a little farther down the docks.
Blazer's face went red from brow to chin, and he pressed his lips together so hard they disappeared. The whisper of steel cut the men's laughter short. Dante stared at the boy's drawn blade. Far too late to call for the watch. They might be out for him anyway.
Blaze raised his arm and threw the sword behind him, and before Dante had time to look past the hand he'd lifted to protect his face, as if it would help against killing steel, Blaze sprung, tackling him to the ground. They rolled in the dust, grappling too closely for their punches to dole out any real hurt. Blaze landed a sharp sting to Dante's nose, and his mind blanked with rage. He got a grip on Blaze's waist, meaning to drive him to the ground. But the boy dropped to his knees and turned his hips and flung Dante onto his back. The boy's knees pinned his shoulders to the ground. He wriggled back and forth, kicking his legs and bucking his shoulders, but he couldn't free his weight. Could only slap weakly at Blaze with arms he couldn't move above the elbows.
Instead, he fell limp, breathing hard.
Blaze jerked his head at Dante's face, as if he meant to batter Dante's brains in with his own skull, then caught himself and leaned back. He got to his feet, brushing dust from his knees and back.
"Do you even realize how stupid it is to try to beat up your clients?"
Dante said from the ground. Blaze bent to pick up his sword and laughed through his nose.
"Wasn't much trying involved.
You took me by surprise. So take another shot."
2 weeks,
Dante said despite his anger, speaking from an instinct he didn't understand and would have overruled in another moment of thought.
"Longer, if you execute your service well."
"I'd hate to disappoint your lordship," Blaze said.
He scratched his ear and gazed down on Dante as if he were considering whether they were actually bargaining for his dignity, then offered Dante a hand and hauled him to his feet. He followed Blaze inside their cramped office and signed a paper, had it stamped, and parted with half his cash. A week's food and lodging in a single room on the edge of the dock slums wiped out the rest. But he had his guard, someone to watch his back while he studied and roamed. And he bent back to his book, alive for a while yet.
He moved from the book's first section to its second, allowing himself one new page of the cycle for every chapter of the background and supplemental works he ploughed through, so the men and places of the book might make sense. He deciphered a foreign word that cropped up on more pages than it was absent from. Nether. His spelling could be off, and Lords knew he had no idea how to pronounce it in the original, but it was the antonym of ether, at least, the words the priests used when they yacked on about the celestial firmament while everyone else twirled their fingers beside their ears. Now that he had this word, certain passages that had been hopelessly obscure were now just uselessly mystical.
"The ether stretches to the nail of the sky and meets itself in the dim caverns below the earth. In the time before time, it was the substance of all things, the water that suspended the stars, the air that made the breath of the gods, the same in all the four corners of the world. Men lived without hunger or death, but the ground grew heavy with their teeming number, and when the mill of the heavens cracked from their weight, the waters broke forth and dashed them upon the peaks. Orion took up the mill once more and set it upon the pole in the north, but when he tried to patch the cracks, he tore his fingers on the shattered stone. He reset its course, but when he made it grind, he found it would grind only nether. When he mingled this dust with the dust of men, they rose with murder in their hearts, remembering how they doomed the sky."
On the surface, that was just a crazy pile of words. no less arbitrary than any of the other explanations he'd heard through the years for why things were the way they were. Bad, usually. But as he read and reread, patient and disciplined in a way he'd never been, taking his time not because some daft instructor insisted he should, but because